Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, a podcast for those who are pathologically interested in history, critical theory, philosophy, aesthetics, or anything that may inform the modern world.
Welcome to Symptomatic Redness. This is part one of our conversation with Matthias Wasser on fascism, the American right, and Leviathan and its enemies.
Welcome to Symptomatic Redness. Today we're talking to Matthias Wasser, which I'm going to mispronounce because I'm tempted to pronounce it the German way and probably wrong in that language too. So the violence that I do to names is somewhat legendary these days. Matthias is a recent graduate of the University of Maryland, a longtime friend of mine from Left Book, and a fellow of the study of the radical right. He is currently a victim of the gig economy and somewhat in the limbo of the lumpen managerial class. And we've been talking about fascism for like 6 years.
So, yeah.
And you and I, we disagreed on some of these things, but you and I actually take pretty strict lines on what counts as fascist, fascistic, neo-fascistic, actually neo-fascist. I mean, like, these terms right now seem particularly thrown around. I don't see it as much these days, but 2 years ago, I remember, you know, the fascist threat of Trump and Steve Bannon's fascism and all this. Actually, it's interesting, as a sub note, maybe we can get to this later. Why has that declined?
Sure. Yeah. So I think that it's a mix of a couple of things. One, it seems that the actual like alt-right street presence has been in decline since Charlottesville, and even the wing of the sort of existing Trump administration that was most flirtatious with them has gotten edged out by the sort of like more traditionally competent technocrats that were part of the traditional Republican coalition. I do think that even if I once took a very strict line on in terms of demarcation on the ground in the past, I think that, you know, maybe the nature of fascism is that it does admit of a lot of, you know, sort of gray areas, you know, and I think that no discourse lasts more than 6 months nowadays, it seems. Mm-hmm. Two, I think there has been a on the ground weakening of the alt-right, at least in the short term. And three, maybe more effective narratives, at least for like broad popular audiences, have emerged on the scene. You know, certainly, you know, there's, you know, the Russiagate stuff and
yeah, the passions of Russiagate.
Right. And I guess a broad sort of narrative, which certainly does have some social scientific support for viewing these in terms of not of a like rising anti-democratic ideology, but just a weakening democratic one. Which I think is also interesting. I think that governance has gotten harder for everyone, most obviously the governing, without necessarily becoming an easier prospect for anyone else, which is another thing we can maybe discuss.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I don't know if you've been following the controversies around the quote-unquote anti-political analytical turn.
No, I haven't. I saw that you interviewed, and here's a name that I'm definitely going to mispronounce, Thaddeus Tietz?
Thaddeus Tietz, yeah.
Dr.
Tad.
Dr. Tad. I can pronounce that. Sounds like she dispenses like dating advice on like a daytime Dr. Tad.
I like Tad a lot, but his last name reminds me of a tropical disease, so...
I'm not too familiar with that. I heard, listened to Douglas Lane interview Dr. Tad, and I wasn't convinced by that interview that there was anything too interesting going on there, but that could easily just be my ignorance.
I think there's a complication between the normative of what like the anti-politicos in which Dr. Tad Tietz is only really the main one. And the descriptive, where I tend to agree with them on the description, and I tend to not know if they have anything normatively at all. That's where the rubber hits the road, and so I like they tend to interpret things as good things that I just interpret as like just kind of base sociological facts. I will say that one of the most fascinating things about this period right now, we can get back to the right, is victory actually was really bad for the right. And that's a strange. I wonder what the DSA is going to learn from that. But but I mean, in some ways, I'm serious because like Charlottesville emerged out of a point of where people thought they were strong, and it just sapped the alt-right like almost more than anything. Yes, and I know Antifa and stuff was involved, and I'm not slagging them off, but that one event did more for the Antifa cause than like 1,000 stick fights in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you make of that? Why did it like peter out so fast? Was it just like the visibility of what it actually wanted to do? Was it Antifa counter presence? Was it just like it was never particularly competent and full of lumpen to begin with? Like what? You know, I suspect all those are true, but
yeah, no. So I definitely don't have like a God's eye view on this, but I do would agree that it is a couple of those things. In particular, and I think this goes both to the idea of overplaying their hands and to the like positive good that Antifa may have done, which is like the point of a street demonstration, right, is a like proxy for the ability to like assemble like a large group of people and like say like, hey, we could impose our political will if we wanted to, or at least we would have a chance, right? So when you loudly proclaim, okay, we're going to get our guys together and we're going to do this demonstration, one, if you're vastly outnumbered, I think that like clearly like shows like where like the advantages are in terms of where popular support would be in a proxy civil war, you know, which these things are sort of at least LARPing in the direction of. And secondly, yeah, it was a very masks off event in terms of like, you know, the torchlit march, and the violence against the, against Heather Heyer and, you know, these, it was showing a degree of confidence, I think, that or acting as a way you would if you were confident, in a way that was belayed by the obvious numbers present on either side, in a way that sort of like, you know, showed their weakness. And I think that as much as sort of like obvious outcry against the violence there, I think that may have played a large part in it petering out. I mean, I don't think outrage and moral scandal on its own can really hurt them, at least at this level of unpopularity, because they already have that and they court that, and that's what their main pitch is at this stage. But I think that,
I think
like
the vision of being incompetent and dangerous at it, though, didn't help them.
Like, oh, no, I think that's part and parcel of it. Yeah, they just kind of look ridiculous, you know, and again, dangerous. So I think that's played a large part in it. There seems to be a lot of small studies suggesting that political violence isn't very effective, especially if you're unpopular. Obviously, political violence is very effective if you already control a state and you want to remain a state. But in terms of, you know, sort of the lone wolf terrorism of, you know, these sort of adventuristic stuff, you know, like, you know, all these church shootings and so on, those are certainly not very politically effective for them either. And obviously, they're probably are not taken for reasons of political effectiveness.
Also, I find a lot of studies that indicated that the counterbalance also doesn't work unless there's actually someone dead. Like, which is an interesting thing to point out. But the one that interested me, that like the counterbalance works if the stakes are seen to justify it. But otherwise, it makes it can risk making the other side look like the underdog in a way that attracts sympathy.
Yeah, no, I can totally believe that. I think probably the most effective cases are where there's not actually any physical confrontation at all. It's just clear assembly of numbers. You know.
Oh yeah, I think the second Unite the Right in DC.
Yeah, okay.
It's like millions descend upon a horde of like 30 people. I'm exaggerating by saying millions, but it's like it was a huge counter protest number. I mean, we're talking like multiple exponential factorial differences in number size.
That was a very nice moment. And I think it's hard once you have that sort of showing, it's hard to claim that you have momentum, you know, and so on. And I think a lot of these a lot of the sexiness of the movement to its actual adherents had a little, at least a significant amount to do with the sense of momentum, right? Which, you know, I guess maybe in terms of, you know, bad things with a Bernie presidency and the DOJ discovering things that you mentioned earlier, could certainly bite us in the ass. But, you know, I mean, I think that for the average activist who takes part in the far right, the sense of something, you know, very romantic and on the move and awakening of the youth and so on, play a major part, even if that, those aren't relevant considerations for elite fractions who might eventually support the rule.
One of the interesting things that I've found about these internet subsets of, you know, righties is that they tend to trend either increasingly insane, like something like Adam Waffen, which has a body count.
Oh, God, yeah.
Or they trend towards just becoming generic conservatives.
right.
I kind of think the Jordan Petersonization of, you know, of the alt-right, where everyone's complaining about Peterson and his fascism, and it's, and there, you know, there's some stuff that's adjacent, I'm not going to lie, but there's also just a lot of just old-fashioned Canadian classical libertarianism, you know.
Oh, sure, yeah. I think when people complain about Jordan Peterson himself being alt-rightish, they're wrong. I think a lot of the elective affinities stem from the fact that he's drawing from a lot of the same intellectual traditions that energized a lot of intellectual fascists in the early 20th century. A lot of the, you know, sort of Eliade and like pre-Eliade religion studies that's very interested in sort of collective myth and myth making and the role that played in sort of anti-rationalist politics among sort of intellectual elites in that period. You know, I think there's a lot of lines there you could do. I think it'd be very easy to do a hot take think piece about it. Peterson himself seems, in his personal politics, both very boring and very opportunistic. So I don't think there's a lot more there than that. But certainly, if you are in that sort of fascist sphere and you're like, you know, in the countercurrents crowd and you like hearing a little more intellectually posh than people who are want to perceive you, then you'll sort of drawing on those currents and connecting back to sort of earlier discourses is something you can certainly do. But
yeah, I mean, I do think that there's a lot of fellow travelers that Peterson probably snapped up, but if anything, that's probably good for us because he's just going to make them boring.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. You know, I mean, if the message is, you know, clean your room, you know, and go outside, you know, I think that's going to be something that, you know, only reduces the sort of objective class basis of needs insofar as any effect. I should say that pursuant to your introduction, I am currently technically a neat. So.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I have been fascinated by, though, is there is a certain demographic of neets and of just downwardly mobile working class and middle class, recently educated people who are and mostly dudes and mostly white, although that can be overplayed in both directions.
Absolutely.
That make up the base of all these movements. Like, it's kind of the same group of people, but, you know, they're like 10 years younger than me. They're usually freshly out of a BA. They're partially employed. They're probably in the gig economy. But that's also like when I went to a DSA meeting, like the DSA has 300 members, but the people who actually show up to the meeting are still those people. Right.
Not too surprised. I mean, I think certainly, you know, if you want to talk about interwar fascism, I mean, the demographic basis of that was middle class, especially downwardly mobile middle class, marginally employed, educated, leans male, leans towards the locally strongest demographic group, unless you're talking about sort of like German minorities, you know, and so on in Central Europe, which were much more inclined towards Nazism than Germans in actual Germany. So people who would have been destined towards bureaucratic careers or who are currently in them, a lot of that may just be sort of the natural basis for any radical movement. And I think that there are definitely some things that are both specific to the right and more generally like point in the direction of people who could be captured by either group. I mean, certainly, like, as you and I know from these sorts of DSA meetings and just Left Book, you know, I mean, there are demographics that you just have more time on their hands, same way we do, and therefore end up looking a lot like us. I feel like it looks like almost like, say, when I look at alt-right communities, it seems like that, but just with stronger selection effects, so it's more obvious, maybe. You know, in that they're even more extremely online, and, you know, interestingly enough, I you know, like, weird gender experiences and identities do seem to be fairly common, although they don't valorize it or, like, accept it in the way we do. But if you, like, hang out in, you know, like, with them when they're speaking to each other privately, they will talk about having weird gender experiences and so on, even if they don't politically endorse that kind of thing. You know,
a lot of the key figures that I've met in real life, and a lot of them were also on the left at one point. They are LGB. I'm not, they're rarely T, but they are LGB. So,
yeah. So, I mean, I think that, you know, I don't know that anybody's really done a good study on this. Most of the real demographic info I have is, again, from the interwar period. So it would, a lot of things would be different. Certainly any, like, you know, gender identity stuff. But it's all the same demographic, like, biases that I see in, like, online communities that form to discuss D&D, right? Disproportionately white, disproportionately young, disproportionately male, disproportionately LGBT.
Disproportionately recently educated.
Yes. Disproportionately on the autistic spectrum, and so on, right? I think, you know, I guess either the technology or the topics or just the, you know, act of, like, discussing this extremely specialized dorky thing that, like, would also, like, filter for me happening to be the kind of person who ends up there, right? It has these same, like, you know, filters, right? And I hit all those check marks, but I hit a bunch of them, you know. So and again, same thing for you and for, right, for
much of our audience. I mean, like, with me it's a little different because I'm older, but but, you know, it's funny because when I was recruited into the right in my college years, it was mostly a meat space thing with, like, antiwar.com, which isn't, I actually don't think is an explicitly right wing site, but it's run by right wingers.
Right. Yeah. I remember that site from high school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's when I was in college. And so, like, that was that world. Yeah, I know. But that was that world, and that world is very different now. Like, when I was reading, I don't know, the off-controversial book, Kill All Normies, which I have issues with, even though, you know, can't talk too much crap about it because it's put up by their publisher. But, and I think one of the things I took away from that book, though, is I didn't really understand the changes that had happened in the right-wing world between the end of Occupy and the gaggle of Pepe Frog Nazis. Like, it was a very different world than the world I knew, even though I had some of the same people in it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the people who ran antiwar.com, you certainly saw them keep on plugging on sort of in the same way. Even as sort of people in their orbit became reference points for the March of Frogs, Hoppe most prominently. I don't know how much they're, maybe I haven't watched, you know, the sort of Mises Institute people close enough to see how they changed through time, if they did, but it seemed like they had kind of kept steady and welcomed the introduction of sort of post-libertarian paleocons that sort of marched through them, afterwards, I said, either total Evolian craziness or traditional conservatism after that. But
well, you know what's interesting about that is I don't feel like the von Mises people, except for Hoppe, who's always been a special sort of, you know, fun, and really changed that much. But the people adjacent to them did. So instead of, I remember when it was even 15 years ago when like LouRotWeckle.com started running Stephen Molyneux stuff for a little while.
He's someone who certainly went pretty masks off in the last couple of years.
Yeah, but the thing is, he was always crazy. Just the crazy changed. Like, Like, I mean, most libertarians thought he was a cult leader, even in the aughts, because he would do stuff, but he would, like, strategically encourage people to isolate themselves from their families and turn increasingly online to, like, his video, you know.
Right, right, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, his mask got off real big. And one of the things that I think you pointed me to was when the Mulbug Land thing happened and how many of them kind of picked up from Hoppe and then, like, put it on Space Crack.
I mean, good description. Yeah.
I mean, like, Nick Land, like, was citing von Mises articles, but also, like, also European New Right stuff. And I don't even know what Mulbug was. I mean, I've read a lot of Mulbug, and I haven't exactly figured out what Mulbug was arguing.
He's not optimized for clarity. I'll say that. I think Mulbug, you know, is probably one of the closer ones to sort of the original sort of Hoppe framework, in that he's beginning from a libertarian base. His main target is, even though he believes in all the edgy race science stuff, is towards the sort of formal rule of democracy is his target. He wants to preserve property rights, and he's really interested in sort of alternate government forms that might instantiate that, right? So he's sure, once he retired from blogging and went into the sort of distributed computing stuff, right? It's very much an extension of Bitcoin, but for everything else, if you assume that, like, our society is going to be increasingly mediated by computing technology and, like, who owns the servers, you know, and so on. So I think that viewing Mulbug's political project as an extension of Hoppe-style democracy critiques into the sort of Bitcoin sphere, and just extending that from money out towards everything else is where I see him going, in a much less radical way than you could characterize Land as doing so.
Have you read the book Right-Wing Critics of American Conservatism?
No, I forget if it was you or someone else who recommended it to me. I've read some reviews of it, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on.
Well, the author, who was mostly sympathetic, sounded like to not so much the paleo libertarians, but just the generic libertarians critique of American conservatism. Listed like Sam Francis and the European New Right and the American attempts of it, and then they talk about at the very end. It talks about neo-reactionaryism, which interestingly kind of faded away in the Trump moment, actually. But it just sort of waves it off as, from what I have seen of Mulbug and Land, it's basically all the old stuff from, like, from the paleoconservatives and the new rightists, but in weirder, more more grotesque clothing. And I and so there's nothing really new there. And I actually, despite all the initial hype, sort of agree, because, like, Mulbug felt like edgy Hoppe. And Land...
edgy Hoppe.
Land is more complicated because the Deleuzian weirdness, which he denies, is still in there. And also, like many of the futurists, he's not big on race science, but not because he's not big on race science, but because he thinks it's too soft on weak white people. So,
well, I think there's a couple of things I could say about that if we really want to get into the weeds.
Yeah, let's get into the weeds.
Okay, sure. So I think there's a very interesting pattern that you see, and this actually, interestingly enough, is not exclusive to white nationalists. You see it in almost any kind of racial nationalist, which is that the critique of the group they themselves belong to and promote can be just as withering as the racism they level at any other racial group, but the critique is always, we're too good, we're too pure, we're just a tiny small bean who just loves to cooperate, and so we cooperate away with our enemies who destroy us. And it's at the formal level, it's interestingly, you know, the same thing as every, you know, critique that someone on sort of the edges, but not the far edges of American, and I assume every other politics, makes of their own quote-unquote party, that, you know, they're, you know, the Democrats are too easy to compromise, you know, and so on. And if you listen to the alt-right, the Republicans are so easy to compromise. You saw this, you know, among Chinese nationalists, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, that, you know, China is just too attached to universal ethical ideals. That has led us astray by trying to copy, the ideas that are coming out of the West. And we really need to assert, you know, muscularly our own, you know, manly, power, which may not come as naturally to us as it does to the brutish other races. You know, some of the Korean nationalism shows up some of the same, themes. You probably know more about than I do, having actually lived.
Yeah. And it started, that actually started left wing wise, believe it or not. People.
Oh, interesting.
So the founder of the concept of Minyok, which is like the blood race concept, was an anarchist who was fighting the Japanese, but used Japanese conceptions to do it, and then came up with the Korean, literally came up with the Korean racial mythology that sounds like it's super ancient about bear people and whatnot, but it's it's actually mostly a modern invention, and it's reinjected in the like popular discourse in both North and South Korea. In fact, the South Korean stuff gets a pass a lot of the time, and when I lived in Egypt, I like saw parallels between left and right a lot more than now that I'm back in America or when I was in Mexico, because there is a certain nascent nationalism in the anti-colonialism that both speak to that isn't as applicable in the United States. Like, although I used to say that I would be surprised if we ever saw a mass blood and soil American right, because like, how do you justify that? We're not from the soil. You know, that's like, it's hard to imagine center colonial blood.
The desert boom, right?
Yeah. It's hard to imagine American, settler colonial, like, blood and soil politics. But I was wrong on that. So.
Well, actually, probably my favorite little sort of American bear people story is the. Is it the Salutrians that the.
Yeah.
That the first people come to North America were Europeans. That gives us the blood right, and the Native Americans were the real genocide, and
you get that in East Asia too with the Turkarians, who were probably Caucasoid. Although let's be honest, like one of the things about racial studies, and you and I have both kind of gotten into this tangentially, is like the idea of whiteness only makes sense as like a post-colonial project. It's one of the things that like one of the frustrations that the alt-right has had in dealing with Europe is they don't know how to deal with micro-nationalisms. I remember like the passions of Richard Spencer about, you know, the decline of the EU, because like he sees the EU as like a white bulwark, and like the anti-EU people are like siding with the Commonwealth. Like UKIP is pro-Africa. And I'm like, this is, you know, and these distinctions make no sense to outsiders, but actually it does kind of make sense to us. But the problem is like that conception of whiteness is a English, French, Spanish settler conception. It doesn't natively make that much sense.
I absolutely agree. I mean, except in the sense that, you know, a lot of European nations had political reasons to sort of make reference to that in starting their own, you know, imperial projects. You know, I mean, I think Italy is the most obvious example. But yeah, no, I think that, like, you know, it does inherently not make a lot of historical sense outside of, you know, this particular historical context, which is why, of course, you have to do so much like mythology making around sort of like primordial, like, you know, concepts that don't exist. Sam Francis, and I know we will get to this.
Oh, yes.
Later. I was just reading a collection of his writings on race, specifically edited by Jared Taylor, who I think also edited or helped publish Leviathan and Its Enemies. And it's fascinating how different his public writings towards a white nationalist crowd differ from Leviathan and Its Enemies, which was never published during his lifetime. He takes an extremely cynical view of sort of racial myth-making in Leviathan and its enemies. He gives a materialist account of why, sort of leftist managerial class, in his view, wants to extinguish racial consciousness. But he also takes an equally cynical view of why colonial and sort of small-town bourgeois order would foster it, right? In his writings for, American Renaissance and these other sort of, race science quarterlies, he seems very uninterested in the sort of sciencey science angle of it, at least when they try to LARP at that. But, sort of the myth-making around it, he's fascinated by it, and he loves to, construct, these conceptions of, who we are as white people, only white people have a belief in objective truth, which is just the sort of, obvious myth that he would clearly, laugh at, in Leviathan and its enemies. And I think it's an open question about where he was being more honest, so to speak. But I think even if he literally believed the race science stuff, functionally, it's more on the more honest side is the materialist analysis he makes elsewhere.
So that's a book that I tell people to read. And I'm always like, you should be careful with it. It's actually pretty powerful evil. But that book, I mean, I remember reading the first 30 pages and this, he just says white nationalism is impossible. And I was like, what? this is San Francis.
he does, even in his public writings towards the rest of the white nationalists, he does say you can't, whiteness isn't enough to form a political community. You have to use something else. I think actually has been, if you watch the sort of young alt-right, they have sort of had some tortured discussions trying to figure out what the proper strategy is. I know Heimbach, before his cult collapsed for sleeping with his stepmom, he and a number of others were proponents of sort of exporting European micronationalism to American soil and carving up the United States into 15 different, white ethnic subregions that would each be, culturally homogenous. And, I guess you'd have sort of Scots, Irish, Appalachian nationalism next to, Puritan New England nationalism or something. I don't know.
It was funny because I remember Humbuck flirting with that. flirting with that, and also reading liberals who were flirting with the same idea, the Seven Nations thesis.
Oh, yeah. No, I know Scott Alexander, who is not in this sphere, but has a lot of readers who are, had a lot of fun with Albion Seed, and that seemed to influence a lot of people in that sphere.
Yeah, I knew just a lot of generic liberals before Trump who were flirting with this stuff, and I'm like, that's nutty. you realize that there's a weird racial core to this book that implies that European blood type is determining the cultures of these micro regions of the United States, and you guys are calling this a progressive analysis. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be totally discharged with the book. There are good points made in that American Nations book. But I've always found that fascinating. Did you ever watch Mr. Show in the 90s?
No, I didn't. I think that was something. I think I was too young and certainly never cool enough to be the show I watched at that time. So
before David Cross got annoying during the Bush years, he did this skit on what was essentially on identity politics and right-wing ideas of dividing America up in the nations, the joke was that the right-wingers carved up a nation for every subgroup to get rid of them and then forgot to give themselves one. But I actually thought it was perceptive in the 90s and early aughts about what they were trying to do. One of the things I've been fascinated with, and then we'll actually define fascism for our listeners.
Sure.
Is the fact that the mask has really dropped under the Trump administration in a way that I haven't seen since maybe the 70s, since the end of formal segregation. Mm. Because in the 90s and aughts, when you read these alt-rightist guys, I mean, and some of them may have been sincere, like Alain Devinois, is one of them where I think he may actually believe this multicultural bullshit. But the Nazis adopted totally multicultural rhetoric. They took out most of the hate stuff. They played down the anti-Semitism. And they played down the anti-Semitism until very recently. Mm-hmm. And so on and so forth. And then after Charlottesville, that all dropped. Like, they just don't make the pretense anymore.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that is?
I think it's a number of things. So one, I think, is the nature of media right now. Both the sort of discourse that everyone has been exposed to about, like, you know, radicalization spirals and, you know, epistemic closure and all that. And also just the ability that it's harder to have, like, an esoteric, exoteric distinction in your discourse, because everything is public right now. Unless you're like five people on a Discord channel, and eventually even that is going to, you know, blow up when someone, like, you know, publishes the logs to everyone else. So I think that it's harder to have masks in the first place. With anti-Semitism in particular, I mean, I think it's really, it serves such a, it or something functionally equivalent just serves such a useful function when you are in the midst of an economic crisis, that I think it would be very surprising if it hadn't, shown up, or again, something functionally similar about, like, I don't know, Freemasons or lizard people, or whatever. I guess it has advantages over the Freemason and lizard people hypotheses in that, you know, the social relevance of those categories is so much lower. So it's a much less sexy story. As someone who has lived in Korea, I would be curious about what, if anything, plays that role other than just sort of Americans.
The Chinese.
The Chinese. Oh, makes perfect sense.
And the Japanese. And to some degree, the Chin Minyuk, which is the Chinese Koreans, who are practically, even though they are Koreans by bloodline and by language, they're practically treated as a separate ethnicity and often seen as bringing in, like, baby pill stuff. The belief that was rampant. You know, I actually have read some things that says it doesn't happen, and I don't believe that. But for those of you who don't know, there's a myth in Asia about traditional Chinese medicine using baby corpses. Usually from from abortion.
They're on the blood libel there.
Yeah, from abortions. And there is some trade in this, but it's not trade in. So it's quartz medicine. Like, that's real. The quartz medicine element of it's real. But you don't kill babies for it. Like, like you tend to use, like, medical waste byproducts and stuff. It's creepy, but it's not. Like, and it's not rampant either. I think it's vastly overstated, but it's all over Korea about China. Also, they feel that, I mean, the more obviously hated successful racial demographic is Japan, but that is more clearly tied to colonialism.
Right.
Whereas the Chinese stuff is seen as, you know, fear of a successful diaspora and maybe colonialism, because China does have some claims on Korea, and there's that. Third of traditional Chosun that's in, I think, Yanning province or something like that, that everybody's, like, quiet about when they talk about it, because Korea was kind of divided three ways, not two. But the explicit anti-imperial anxiety is aimed at Japan, but there's this sub stuff about China that's really there. And that China fear is actually all over the world. Like,
after, I imagine.
And it was the biggest thing I encountered in Mexico, of all places.
Oh, really?
It's historically related to, you know, the Chinese workers going all the way back to the same Chinese workers came and worked and were out in the United States. But there have been many massacres of Chinese before them being too successful in Mexico, and it was, like, the acceptable prejudice. It was one of the few racisms that was really, like, okay. Like, being anti-black was okay low-key, but not explicitly ever. And, like, you could hate American government and be annoyed by gringos, but you couldn't, like, hate gringos on principle. But, like, some people did that with China. And it was the same narrative you had about Jews. In fact, because I remember arguing with Douglas Lane about this. He's like, well, what other group in the world other than Jews has this? And I was like, the Chinese diaspora, the Parsi diaspora in India, which has similar ethnic rules. And so works very, it's a clear parallel to Judaism. Even probably is why Jews do things they do, because of the proximity to Zoroastrianism. particularly in the Babylonian Talmud period.
Oh yeah, yeah.
No, we're really off topic, but yeah, I mean, like, but in India, the Parsi served the same function there too. It's kind of the successful minority that you kind of, it's okay to hate and occasionally massacre, but there, it's a weird, because you look down on them as subhuman, but also you envy them because they're successful, whereas like they're, you know, unlike the other great unwashed horde aren't. So it's not only the Jews, but it is interesting that Judaism stuff happens everywhere. Interestingly, in Korea, though, a lot of anti-Semitic tropes were seen as positive, and the Koreans like to compare themselves to Jews. So I don't want to be like I literally bought a book called The Talmud for Koreans. It was like the short 80-page book from a book vending machine in a subway. And I was like, this is bizarre, but it was just a common thing over there. They're like, no, the Jews resisted the Germans. And, you know, the Germans are linked to the Japanese, and fuck those guys. So, you know, occasionally somebody would say something that would, like, horrify me, but they would mean it in a positive way. Like, we need to learn from the Jews on how to control the media. And, like, they were, like, saying it as, like, admiration. And I'm like... I mean, yeah, like most of the CEOs in Hollywood are Jewish. That actually is true. It's a fluke of history because of migration patterns. But we don't have a conspiracy. I mean, like, there's not, I don't know of any Jew gold.
Yeah, no, I just technically married into the tribe this month. I haven't been told of any secrets yet, but maybe. Maybe there's a grace period, I don't know.
So, yeah, I mean, so that is fascinating to me. But I mean, there are some things, occasionally the Nazis will hit on something interesting. Have you read Heidegger's Black Book?
No, I have it on my short list of things to read. You talk about the metaphysical anti-Semitism stuff, which
is
pretty non-metaphysical in the Black Books, is my understanding.
It's metaphysical anti-Semitism. It's just explicit, but it's not, it's interesting because he doesn't justify it on racial grounds. I mean, he does, he blames Jewish ethnocentrism from kind of inventing the idea of race in the first place, which is both ludicrous, but also a little true, so...
Well, there certainly is something to like the model that's presented in the Old Testament that gets used as a discursive frame for everyone else, right? Like, I feel like you could build a good joke around the idea that like no group has a national consciousness until somebody invents a theory that they're the real Jews.
Right.
you certainly see that, with you know, British Israelism and, various forms of, some white nationalist groups. And, there was even a guy in Japan, who formed a theory that the Japanese were formed from some of the missing tribes. So,
it was a hot thing to do in the 19th century, apparently. Yeah. Like, I read a whole book on like the 37 different theories on missing tribes, and and a lot of them do become weird nationalist groups later on. So, or they become weird religious sects, or even not that weird religious sect in the case of the LDS, but still. Yeah. So let's define fascism, and I have a thesis that so we can get into the theoretical core of this instead of like the kind of tangential stuff. I have a thesis that there is a direct relationship between both the decline of the left and fascism, but also the decline of traditional religious communities in fascism. And I think people kind of intuitively grok the first one, or they're in deep denial about it. But they don't so much intuitively get the second claim. And one of the things I found fascinating was I started studying in my whiteness studies, you know, the Portuguese kind of invent it. But then I start studying how it gets defined, how Europeanness gets defined, how whiteness gets defined. And it totally is dependent on your views of Christendom.
Mm-hmm.
Like who counts and who doesn't count ties not back to any, not, it's not even like morphologically related. It's literally like you can literally tie it to like different groups' view of who counted as a Christian and not.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so the Portuguese invent the category of right and black, right? But they're almost immediately excluded from it in British categorizations because they're Catholics and thus don't count.
Right.
And the idea of, like, Asians as a separate race from Europeans is tied to giving up on trying to convert them.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, certainly, like, if you want to like look at, you know, what the antecedents were in terms of like how do we define like the group that we're currently defining as white, right? It is sort of Christendom with a lot of the sort of intra white nationalist or just intra generally racist disputes corresponding to, Protestant versus Catholic versus Slavic. And you can either define, you know, yourself as like, you know, just Latin Christendom or just the Protestant countries or even some like smaller subgroup of that ends up being the degrees of inclusiveness to which they reach. And some of the race science people even try to like connect it to that explicitly, you know, with the Heinel line and other sort of attempts to rationalize that connection there.
So let's talk about how do you, Matthias, define fascism?
All right. Sure. So in my dissertation, I sort of avoided the question by trying not to use the word fascism, and just using whatever like relevant consideration I use, because I actually do think that the boundaries end up being pretty porous, and that's ends up why it being used so fluidly. But I guess I would say that fascism, broadly speaking, I would define in terms of. All right, well, the definition I've got to give might actually be too narrow in that it excludes, like, certain, like, really radical third positionist groups, but I view them as politically irrelevant in the long term, so it doesn't matter. But basically, the attempt to defend and continue capitalist property relations while throwing out the ideological, you know, superstructure of liberalism entirely. And that definitely misses out on some groups that it probably does like naturally include when we use the term fascism, like these radical third positionist groups. It definitely fails to capture some, you know, groups like, you know, say like Italian fascism for most of its history, which was not an entire break with liberalism, but I'm happy to use that as a starting point that captures some important dynamics. And I'm be happy to hear how you would define it. And then we can continue to,
Well, the first thing I'd like to do is piss on that stupid Umberto Eco essay that oh, it's back
awful, like awful. It's just a bunch of surface features collected that he doesn't like.
Right. I mean, and like a lot of them are like a lot of the surface features apply to most politics. So
right. It's naming the enemy.
Yeah. Naming the enemy. A romantic view of the past. Like who doesn't have, I mean, including leftists, frankly, and liberals, who doesn't have a romantic view of the past? No, I am fascinated by the ways in which fascism really was a synthesis between left and right in a real sense. I mean, like, it comes out of both trajectories. It comes out of, like, the radical, like, you know, conservative revolutionaryism of, like, Marat in France. But also Soros, and I mean Mussolini was like almost an ultra leftist.
You don't get Soros without Sorrel, so
yeah, and you don't get you literally don't get fascism without a bunch of defectors from the Italian Socialist League. So right, yeah. Some of whom were even like left com adjacent at one point. I mean, like that's how far they went.
Well, they're anarcho syndicalist
anti-syndicalist. You know, so I mean, like, there's a lot of that. Then you have, which morphs into the national syndicalist, which is really the core of the group that would become the left wing of fascism. but fascism doesn't follow that trajectory everywhere, which makes it really complicated. It doesn't follow that in Romania. It doesn't
follow that in Germany.
A branch of it follows it in Germany, but that's the branch that gets eradicated.
Right. Well, functionally the same in Italy. They don't murder or imprison as many dissident left-wing fascists in Italy as almost anywhere else. But you know, they certainly sideline them and just like leave them at like sort of tenured university professions, which I guess is the liberal method of dealing with leftists. But
yeah, I mean, you know, Gentile is kind of the exception because he's crucial to Mussolini, and Mussolini is also coming out of the left wing of fascism where Hitler doesn't. But then Falangism, which is fascist adjacent, but isn't really fascist. It's too tied up in church politics.
Well, I mean, if you're defining the Romanians, the Iron Guard as fascist, it certainly you know, was very tied up in, you know, church politics. Maybe, yeah, well, not.
Do you define the Romanian guard as fascist? The Iron Guard?
I would say, I mean, I don't want to be too attached to definitions, because I think definitions are best used provisionally. But I think that in terms of, you know, defining groups by family resemblance, I would view the Iron Guard as close to the center of the cluster as you could possibly get. And the Phalange might be a little further out, partially because they are a lot closer, not just to the church as an ideological ideal, but towards very traditional elites. You see a synthesis between the sort of like young right activists and traditional elites in every case that you have fascism coming to power. But certainly the boundaries are, there's a less radical break there in the Spanish case, partially because that movement was led by the traditional elites, which in turn was because there was a stronger leftist threat there.
One of the more fascinating things, though, is the German case where the conservative revolutionary movement never embraced the fascists wholly, or in some cases at all. I mean, both Spengler and Ernst Jünger and those guys. Yeah, I mean, like, I remember debating, and I did a podcast on this 4 years ago. I ended up debating on whether or not I don't think you can count them as fascist, considering they explicitly oppose them. But in Italy, those conservative revolutionaries, when Mussolini made four ways and a kind of tacit, well, not an explicit deal with the church, they get pulled in, even though that there's still kind of a more active left wing of fascism there. In Germany, the Nazis are almost like, you know, the eliminationist centrist in this weird way, because they don't pull the conservative revolutionaries in either. They tend to alienate them, you know, including some of their generals. I mean, there's, you know, Rommel and the guy who tried to assassinate Hitler, who were definitely in that conservative, you know, old guard. Revolutionary old guard, even place, and I think it's very hard to talk about fascism as anything other than domain specific in a way that does make the category almost useless. But because one of the things I do want to point out is reactionaryism is not always, in fact, often and generally isn't fascist, and there are weirdnesses right now. Fourth positionism, which liberals have found, it's funny. You and I used to talk about how scary this was.
Dugin stuff.
Yeah, we talked about how scary this was 8 years ago, and by the time liberals found it, it wasn't scary at all. I'm like, yeah. Like Putin had already like exiled him. He'd lost his Dugin lost his Moscow University post. I mean, he was making forays into Alex Jones, not out of a position of strength, and everybody else was like, "Oh, Dugin is secretly advising Putin." I'm like, "What are you on? You know nothing about Russia." Like, those guys got more and more desperate. I mean, they did do so. In so much of there's ever been that red brown stuff is always overplayed. I mean,
yeah.
It is in America. It's extremely overplayed.
Right. I mean, there are systematic reasons to overplay it.
Right. But it was real that the Duginists actually did try to enter left wing groups and had some success with some of the anti-imperial like ML groups. Right. The former leader of the WWP being like a former leader, not the former leader, WWP being a huge example of that. But it's still pretty rare.
I definitely have some e-friends who went almost directly from Maoism, Third Worldism to not quite alt-right, but weirdly accepting sort of the nationalist premises of both simultaneously. But yeah, I don't want to overplay that because it's not the main strand.
American fourth positionism, like they if you read their positions and you read like the PSL's foreign policy or the WWP's foreign policy statements, they're almost identical.
Right.
Which should worry people. I mean, like also like the Juice League was almost all right wingers until about 5 years ago. I mean, like.
I also even wouldn't overplay those relationships insofar as like if your primary, you know, like principle is being against something, in this case American imperialism, then that leaves like 200 degrees of freedom for everything else. Certainly I can think of some personal cases of people who have done that crossover, and if you take a lot of anti-imperialist rhetoric in its most naive form and take it literally, then it does like entail embracing a lot of like goofy nationalist premises that don't like hold up to examination at all, but if accepted would lead you in a very creepy direction.
Right. I think a lot of that is that, I mean, a lot of anarchists, I mean, I can think of one anarchist journalist who really pushes this.
And yes, we're thinking of the same person.
I don't want to alienate that person. I eventually want to talk to them, but at the same token, I find some of the extents of what they're quote unquote finding to be like kind of laughable. Like 5 dudes on the internet defected for real. And that was scary. And I was scared by it too when I saw it. Then I like dealt with people in real life and realized those 5 dudes are parts of sect groups that even if all the sect went with them and they didn't, you're still only talking like 200 people.
Right, yeah.
Like that's not a Russiagate level conspiracy.
Right, yeah. This pertains to some of our previous discussions, like in this conversation, but I think that I wonder how much of that is due towards, you know, these sort of ideological affinities that you can point out at the margins, which you could probably find between any two large political position sets that like have opinions on lots of things, and just these sort of like psychological dimension of like being young and restless and like intellectually radical and wanting to embrace something that like, you know, épaté le bourgeois, you know.
And for a lot of people, it's completely divorced from their daily life. Like,
of course, yeah.
You remember the Atasha controversies and, you know, the one of them who started endorsing like fascism is good, but it didn't kill enough people because they're green. They were like hyper green anti civilizationist and basically eventually embraced like total life destruction. and that green anarchist overlap with fascism is also not new. You can, again, it can be overplayed, but Troy Southgate really was like getting Green Anarchy magazine to publish his shit in the 90s. Like, so that really did happen. And for those people who haven't listened to me on talking about this, Troy Southgate is a British national figure who moved to America and started the National Anarchist and like is a weird Avoliat rightist and, is, you know, was an influence on Richard Spencer, et cetera, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And he wrote for Green Anarchy magazine and recruited a lot of post-left anarchists into the fascist movement, essentially. That did happen, and it's happened more than once. And yes, there, you know, people, I remember hearing all the people claim that in that New Zealand shooters, the Australian guy who was the New Zealand shooters manifesto saying that was all trolling. And well, I'm like, yes, it was, but I think he was also being honest a lot of the time.
Right. There's definitely not a like hard distinction between those things.
No, I mean, a lot of people troll themselves into Nazi positions in the first place. So, right. But when they were like, oh, no, he doesn't really mean the environmentalism because that's too much. And like, no, they mean it. That's not even new. Like, that's been part of the ideology forever.
Right. Greg Johnson's recent manifesto is explicitly based in sort of a conservationist reason thing where he says like we need to defend white people as an endangered species.
Well, I mean, we all know human biodiversity is code for racialism now, but right, exactly. People forget that actually started out as a left wing thing.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Yeah,
obviously the biodiversity phrasing.
It started off as an anthropological movement to conserve languages and cultures.
Oh, fascinating.
It was the analogy to biodiversity was an analogy. It wasn't supposed to be literal.
Huh. And I did not know the history of that phrase there.
One of the anthropologists who's most big on debunked in HBO claims is the guy who coined the term, and he coined it for the opposite purpose. I mean, like, so this is what I'm talking about, that trend in the 90s to, like, co-opt left-wing terminology. I mean, and again, that's not new at all. It's, I mean, like, Mussolini's proletarian nation stuff.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Is all, but it's not, is not surprising. But the thing is, they don't even try to do it anymore. And some of those terms have only been retained as racial terms now. The original not racialist meaning has been completely lost.
Well, sure, that's just Gresham's law for phrasing.
Exactly. But it's interesting that we talked about this earlier, that pipeline has been closed down because I think it largely didn't work. Mm-hmm. Like, people got the game pretty quickly. Right. But the environmental stuff does have a logic. I mean, the Malthusianism has, like, even liberal Malthusianists, there's some weird racial shit that people should, like, call out more. Like, because who's going to die? When you focus on overpopulation, oh, sure, yeah. David Attenborough, you're aiming mostly at brown people.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, I think that's That's a, I think it's a well-trod topic, you know, that, I think most people on like the left would endorse, even if a lot of liberals like to use a lot of population rhetoric, maybe less than they used to, but.
Well, I think it's less than they used to, except when they get all ornery about climate change. I mean, the whole David Attenborough thing, I do think there's more of an awareness because liberals are not as cordoned off from leftists these days. But one of the benefits of the online world is they actually do hear our arguments because we yell at them all the time. And not just like at coffee houses alone with five other people.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think that has, I mean, like even, I think the 2016 campaign was when I realized we weren't totally ghettoized anymore. I mean, we are, but.
Yeah. But like, we're relevant, but not ghettoized.
but people hear what's coming out of that ghetto now.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh, Hillary Clinton's doing peons or certain kinds of like internet rhetoric that there's no that in the 90s she would have given a shit about.
Oh, of course, yeah. Or even as early as 2012, right? If you compare her rhetoric in that campaign to no, not 2012, 2008.
Yeah. Oh my. Well, in 2008, she was pulling some Trumpy shit, actually.
Oh, absolutely. You know. And then in 2016, she had her incoherent intersectionality chart that she.
Yeah, I mean, well, the funny thing is what. As a side note, I love picking on Ta-Nehisi Coates, but is Ta-Nehisi Coates had an interesting logic about why they prefer Clinton over Bernie on this, because Clinton had more of a bad history to hold her accountable to. You didn't have as much with Bernie. I mean, he said that explicitly.
Oh, that's really interesting. Maybe is certainly an overestimation of the conscience of these people, but it's not a totally incoherent account. Certainly.
Yeah, I mean, I actually thought that there was some interesting truth to that. I mean, like. But and also to give Coates his due, he was a Bernie supporter. He was just trying to explain the logic to why Clinton made some sense.
Yeah,
I think he was missing that the Southern machine politics, the Dixiecrats used, just got passed on to the Black Congressional Caucus when you know a lot of the Dixiecrats just changed the D to an R.
But, yeah,
you know, and thus that's really why it is. But you know. Southern politics is hard for the rest of the country to often understand.
Sure. And to be fair to Coates, he is a radical pessimist, even maybe more so than you. I think a lot of his claims should be viewed through that lens. And also he deserves some credit for, like you often, being right just on that basis.
Yeah, he's a radical pessimist, but like liberally about it.
Well, sure, he's liberal.
Well, also, I mean, like, let's be honest. If my audience was like fairly elite white witch people who I wanted to feel guilty, I would do a lot of the same things. Like, so, you know, I got to give Hustle what it's due.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's episode. Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives are produced for Zero Books by the team of C. Derek Varn, J.G. Michael, Amogh Sahu, and Toby Kamir, our ever faithful producer and editor. Please keep following us on the Inside Zero Books Patreon account for additional episodes. Have a good day.